Start off with, this is the second session of the interview with Govindan.
With Anthony Earl.
In February 1987, we're back in the, we're in the oral history office. I would like to talk, to ask you first what your contacts were on the Madison campus as you were during your campaign and as you started off as governor.
Well, during the campaign in 1982, a number of people who were part of the campus community were supportive. Henry and Virginia Hart, Hank and Ann Rita Lardy, Ed Miller and Midge. They were among some of the people who were the most active. Ralph Andriano, Dennis Dreesang, a number of those folks were deeply involved. And in a formal context, that is not in a political context of helping out the campaign, but in a formal context, keeping in touch. I was in touch with people like Harry Peterson, representing Irv Shane, and I was in touch with Bob O'Neill. I had gotten to know him a bit, but not very well, but I was in touch with him and would see him at some events. So there are two levels of keeping in touch. One was the political level, the effort of folks who were helping me out. Oh, I shouldn't forget Ted and Dorothy Shannon, for example. They were very, very active. And on the other level were those who were keeping in touch with the candidates in a sense of making sure that whichever candidate was successful would know whom to contact once the election was over. My strongest support in my campaign came from Madison, and a great deal of that strong support was from the university community. As soon as the election was over, the level of contact between me and people like Bob O'Neill and then Chancellor Shane picked up considerably because they knew that the budget was on us, and I met with them on a fairly regular basis. One of the first meetings I had after the election in the transition office was with Bob O'Neill, the late Robert Knowles, and Ben Lawton to talk a bit about the university budget. And then we subsequently met with Irv Shane and Bob O'Neill and talked about the university budget.
And were they people that you were also getting advice from?
Yes. Yes, I got advice from them. And as you might recall, it was a very difficult time economically. Things continued to deteriorate. It was pretty tough in November, but it got even worse in December and even worse yet in January. The unemployment continued to climb. We were right at the trough of the recession, I think, then. So it was an extraordinarily difficult time, and everybody understood that it would be a hard budget, the one I was going to put together, but there was a great deal of interest in trying to make sure that it was a budget that would not endanger the university. And it was with that in mind that I sought and received the advice of those folks. And of course, throughout the time I was candidate and governor, I remained in close touch with Ben Lawton, who was the president of the Regents, who was a personal friend and someone whose judgment I respect greatly.
He was already president, was he?
I think he was. Let me refresh my recollection. No, he was not. David Beckwith was the president at the time. That's right. David Beckwith was the president of the Regents when I came
into
office.
I think Lawton became president in 84.
Right. That's
just
correct.
Just before the
That's correct.
Struggle started.
It was David Beckwith.
Uh-huh.
But Ben Lawton was in closer touch with me than David was, probably in large part because of our personal friendship. Conversations on the budget with Bob O'Neill and Chancellor Shane, focused on trying to make up for some of the cuts of the previous administration. There had been a lot of across-the-board cuts. The style of my predecessor was to cut all programs alike, a philosophy I don't agree with. But it had had especially damaging effects on the university, according to those who represented the university, and it's a point of view that I believed as well, so that the essential programs got cut as well as the merely desirable programs. Bob felt and Irv felt that something had to be done in the area of libraries, that they'd really suffered some serious loss in libraries and asked for library funding, and also asked for increase in instructional support. We talked at that time about the necessity of breaking away from the funding formula which related so directly to body count. Mm-hmm. In the legislature, I never liked that. As a candidate, I didn't like it. As governor, I wanted to get away from it and use some other measurement as to how we finance the campuses rather than body count. I didn't agree with it as a sound way to finance higher education in the first instance, but beyond that, it led to this very untoward competition to get bodies, because if La Crosse got more bodies than Eau Claire, then La Crosse would get more money than Eau Claire, mm-hmm. and there'd be this fighting for students on that basis rather than what the area of expertise in those campuses were. So when the budget was being put together, there was a special emphasis on instructional funding, changing the student funding formula, and libraries. By the time we got there to that point, I said, this isn't going to leave much, if anything, for salary. And as a matter of fact, I don't know how I'm going to be able to offer much, if anything, to any state employees for salary. Now, the context of this is November, December, January, 1982-1983. At that time, it was pretty well agreed that there probably couldn't be a salary increase. There probably wasn't money for that. But in an effort to offer something to the faculty and something to state employees, we said we'd pick up the employees' contribution to the retirement fund, which was worth a little more than 1%. And that was indeed what was ultimately our offer for state employees and faculty members. That didn't seem to bother too many people at that time. It seemed to be fairly widely understood. Private sector enterprises were going down. The unemployment rate in the private sector was 13%, I believe. It was only, unfortunately, when we started to come out of the recession a bit, at which time the budget was then in its final stages in the legislature, and that's in May and June of 1983, that the furor over the freeze began. And when that got started, it really snowballed, and it was a very unpopular thing as the budget came to conclusion. And it was my most difficult time with the university community. Much more difficult, I think, than the subsequent fight over ketchup was. Because there were a good many in the university community who didn't understand, or chose not to understand, the origin of the freeze, which was November, December, January, when we didn't have any money, and felt that the decision was just being made in May, June, when it was apparent we were starting to come out of the recession. And I appeared before a variety of faculty assemblages. I appeared before the Faculty Senate in the auditorium here in Madison. I appeared before the Faculty Senate in Whitewater. I met with faculty groups at Stout and Stevens Point and other communities to explain what the situation was and why. And if you go back and take a look at the clippings, though I was, I think, respectfully received, you cannot miss the fire that was in the eyes of a lot of the people who were there. And what troubled me and what caused me some grief was that it was perceived by some, not as a manifestation of the difficult economic times in which we found ourselves, but as a willful judgment to squeeze down the university, as if I was doing this to the university and it wasn't a part of the larger picture. And I had a great deal of difficulty trying to persuade people that wasn't the case. I can recall in particular at Whitewater when a faculty member got up and said, you just don't understand that we are an extraordinarily valuable asset to the state and we have got to be paid. The fellow said, how am I supposed to make it on $46,000 a year, whatever it was? I said, my God, to your west in Janesville, there are X number of thousands of auto workers laid off. To your east in Kenosha, there's another X number of thousand. They'd be delighted to try to make it on $46,000. They are not working, and in that they are not working, they are not paying taxes, so there isn't the wherewithal to give you the kind of money that your education and your importance to the society would otherwise dictate. Water off a duck's back. It just didn't translate to a lot of people. And that caused a very difficult time in university relations, though I think most of the regents and most of central administration understood what the situation was. There was an 11th hour effort by Bob O'Neill to get some kind of a faculty pay raise in the budget. And it put me in a very embarrassing spot because I had to get to the Finance Committee and oppose it because it would have only given faculty a bump and not the rest of all state employees. And we would have just had all kinds of difficulty on our hands. We were in the process of negotiating the 0% pay increase with other state employees, so there's no way I felt that we could have done it at that time. So that was probably the low ebb of my relationship with the university. At the same time, I had pushed through a very substantial change in our unemployment compensation law. We were terribly in deficit. We were fourth highest in the country in benefits and 34th or something like that in taxes. And the result was predictable. We were not only broke, we were borrowing $1 million a day, every day, 7 days a week, just to keep the checks in the mail. As a result of the change I proposed, benefits were cut, taxes were increased, and we were then and are now about 11th or 12th in both benefits and taxes. By the time I'd left office, the debt, which had reached $750 million, had been paid off, and we were living on our own money, and everybody's congratulating themselves about how Wisconsin, unique among the states that went into debt for unemployment, had come out. But not too many people remember that. They do remember early 83. A lot of people in organized labor remember in early 83 when we went through the wrenching business of changing unemployment compensation. Similarly, some people in the university community still remember the freeze and don't fully appreciate, I think, the situation we're in at the time, which dictated it. Nonetheless, the freeze and the consequent unhappiness that some exhibit as a result of that did not seriously affect the relations between me, Bob O'Neill, the regents. They remain good. And when the second budget cycle ran around, we were able to rectify, more than rectify, some of the problems that resulted from the freeze. After the first budget was done, I appointed a committee to take a look at the university and how it stood with its peers in terms of compensation.
Well, I'm going to stop you here.
All right,
because
okay.
I'd like to go into a little more detail on the freeze and the STAR fund, which indeed, as you say, people do remember. Mm. Do you You remember whose idea the
Star Fund?
There were two Star Funds. Well, the first Star Fund was $1 million, wasn't it?
Yes.
Do you remember how that came up?
It came up in conversations very early with Chancellor Shane and Bob O'Neill when we were talking about the inability to make very significant across the board, and the question was raised, you know, we're really in trouble, and a lot of others are in trouble too, but we ought to have something available to hold on to the star faculty mm-hmm. in case that somebody tries to grab them off. We have got to somehow be able to manifest our appreciation for their worth to us, and thus the Star Fund concept was created. Who actually articulated it? I can't recall. It was a product of informal discussions, mm-hmm. and so thus the Star Fund was established. Well, it was a misbegotten idea. Well, I don't know if it was a misbegotten idea, but it certainly was never marketed in a very, that's a terrible word to use. It was never explained to people in a very satisfactory way.
People outside the university, you mean, or inside?
Outside the university and inside the university. The interesting thing was, is so often is the case, the campuses outside of Madison all thought that the Star Fund was exclusively for Madison, and it was going to be largely for Madison in any event. Mm. And the Madison faculty thought it was a pittance and an insult. $1 million wouldn't begin to take care of the stars here. So it won no favors here in Madison and won the wrath of people in the other campuses.
And then there was, from what you say, there wasn't any real possibility of raising salaries at that time, but people on the campus say that there was a question of timing and that you felt that you hadn't been told in time about the desperate state of faculty salaries.
No, I understood what the situation was, but as I said, when I was preparing the budget, it was the state's finances were in desperate shape. Mm-hmm. We not only couldn't pay more than we were paying, we were slipping deeper and deeper into deficit. Once we cured the deficit, or were well on the way to curing the deficit, people chose to forget about it right away. Nobody will ever know how large the deficit would have been. That's all speculation. Mm-hmm. Suffice it to say, it was $300 and some million the day I took office. That very day I called a special session and said, make the sales tax permanent, add a 10% surcharge on the income tax, and I put a freeze on all state hiring. Not draconian, but pretty strong mm-hmm. stuff. And that had begun to have a positive effect by the time that the budget was making its way to conclusion in May and June. Uh-huh. And I certainly understood the tough spot the faculty was in, understood that faculty salaries were not competitive. But it wasn't a result just of the freeze. There had been a steady 10, 11, 12 year deterioration in the competitive position of the university on the salary matter. And the freeze seemed to exacerbate it in people's minds, but the freeze itself wasn't what caused the desperate faculty compensation problem.
I know you got awful letters from people. I mean, were they from as much from the other campuses as from Madison or Moore or?
It varied. I got a fair amount. Stevens Point had a faculty group that was terribly unhappy, and they used to keep in touch with me on a regular basis. But most of the letters, I think, were from Madison. Mm-hmm. And the anxiety about losing faculty ran the deepest here. And the faculty that comes to this campus are the faculty who are most likely to be urged to move. I don't mean to diminish the other campuses, but I can't imagine that there would be nearly as regular an effort to get faculty to go from, say, Whitewater or Stevens Point or Oshkosh to move on to other schools as there would be from this Madison campus. So the real honest concern about loss of faculty ran deeper here than it ran on other campuses. Now, that was used as a rubric, loss of quality faculty, to legitimize an argument for we'd like more money, people who just wanted more money. And hell, I understand that, I'm not naive. But in some places it didn't ring as true as other places.
Well, then there is the little glitch that happened in the Joint Finance Committee.
Right near the end, yeah. I don't recall all the details of it well, but I remember it was an 11th hour effort, as I said, on the part of the administration to try to get something to try to get something that would enable the university to get more money to more people, and the instrument that was used was the STAR Fund in an effort to expand it rather dramatically so that STAR could be more broadly interpreted. The STAR category wouldn't be kept just for the supernovas, but would cover more people.
Well, it was Feingold, I guess.
I think
proposed
it was.
Proposed $2.5 million to be added to that, to
yes.
the initial $1 million.
Yes.
And apparently you and O'Neill met just before the Joint Finance Committee meeting?
Right near the end,
and
yes.
And he thought this was a permanent addition to salaries?
Oh, yeah. Oh yes, that was
and
a...
That was the...
And I... No, that's correct. There was a misunderstanding between us. I saw this not as an add to the base, but rather to be treated as a kind of a bonus, and he saw it as added to the base.
Yeah.
Yes, there was that difference between, but it was I think it was simply an honest misunderstanding. I don't think either one of us was intentionally trying to deceive the other. I never felt that of Bob O'Neill.
He was quite upset about it.
Yes, yes. But always the gentleman. He never, in the time he was here, the time he dealt with me, publicly or privately, engaged in some of the purple rhetoric of his peers. He never engaged in some of the doomsday kind of stuff that Irv was wont to do from time to time. I think it served Bob in good stead, frankly. It certainly served him in good stead with me, and I think it served him in good stead with the legislature. As I mentioned previously, if those who speak for the university are always crying wolf, the people at the other end of State Street simply stop listening after a while. Mm-hmm. And to Bob O'Neill's great credit, he did not use that tactic. He might have expressed great disappointment. He might have said, this will hurt us in our effort to be competitive. And he would say those kinds of things. But he wouldn't say, well, the world's going to end Thursday at 8 a.m. sharp as a result mm-hmm. of this. And what Bob and I had talked about, and subsequently did, and perhaps we'll get to this in your questions, what we talked about is the problem is a serious one. That is faculty compensation and competition and rating of quality faculty. The problem has been developing over a long period of time. It wasn't occasioned simply by the freeze, though that certainly made it more visible. That it ought be addressed in a comprehensive way. Somebody ought to take a look at it. And that it ought be addressed not just as it affects this campus, but the entire university system. And it ought be addressed in a forum that isn't under the same heavy constraints to do something right now as Joint Finance is. Take it out of the budget context and give us a chance to take a look at it. Thus was born the Faculty Compensation Review Committee. Mm-hmm. And the people we put on it were top-notch people. We did not, either of us, Bob or I, have a preconceived notion as to what the result ought to be. And we put people on from non-Madison campuses as well as Madison campuses, legislators, faculty, And I kept very close track of what was going on. I know the difficulty they had establishing peer groups, most especially the difficulty with the non-Madison campuses. But they worked at it very diligently, worked at it very hard, came up with a unanimous vote, which many of them subsequently forgot, because there were people who represented the non-doctoral campuses who subsequently disavowed any involvement at all with the compensation study. I thought that what they did was a pretty good job, and I subsequently, as you know, I subsequently adopted their recommendations, once they'd also been approved by the regents, into my budget.
Yeah. On the task force, whose advice did you get on what members to appoint?
Well, Bob and I did that.
Did you know for sure would be on it?
Well, I thought Ben Lawton certainly ought to be on it, because this was a matter of which he felt very deeply about. And I also thought it was important to have a highly visible member of the regents. Some of the other members were chosen to provide...
To Bartleben, you mean?
To provide balance. Yes.
Mary Lou Munz, why did you put her on?
She was at that time the co-chair of Joint Finance. And a great friend of the university, but also someone who understood the practical limitations about how far the state could go. Mm-hmm. Dick Coy from Eau Claire was on. He was a faculty member who was also a TELF member.
Yeah.
And wanted him to represent that point of view.
Did you know him?
Yes, I'd known.
He had health problems, is that right?
He had had a heart attack at some point. I don't recall when that happened, but he'd been the head of the Eau Claire County Labor Council, active in TELF, so he had a labor background as well as being affiliated with the university. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember the names of all the other folks.
Well, there was somebody, a very important person, Mary Lou said, from the Southeast, who was in a union man, an old union man, AFL-CIO, who was the person whose support for the differential position was crucial.
Is that Kenny Germanson?
I don't know, she didn't say his name.
I think it might have been, I'm trying to recall, I think it was Kenny Germanson.
Was he one of your appointees, or
yes.
Somebody suggested to you?
No, he was one of my appointees. I wanted to make sure there was somebody on from labor, and I'm almost certain it was Kenny. He's with the Allied Industrial Workers and a very fine guy. I'm having some difficulty recalling.
Well, there was
all
somebody from Janesville, a musician who was an old line Democrat.
Sure, Ted Kinnaman.
Yes.
And Ted was on as a representative. I asked Ted to be on as representative of the two-year campuses.
Uh-huh.
He was very effective. The two-year campuses, as you may recall, were recommended for a 15% increase, as well as UW-Madison.
Mm-hmm.
Now, their increase was very clearly and very explicitly based on the fact that they were having a hard time being competitive with high school teachers. It was not rating faculty. It was simply to get them up at a decent level and to not treat the center system is the poor cousin. All right.
Harry Peterson says that it was by no means a foregone conclusion that they'd come out in favor of the differential.
That's correct.
What was your view about a differential for Madison?
I certainly thought that the differential was important. There were two differentials at stake, both of which were accomplished, both of which I think are far more significant than has been acknowledged. The first differential was that for the first time in my political lifetime, a judgment was made that University of Wisconsin faculty ought to be treated differently from all other state employees. A very important break, because in the past, if there was 6% to be made available, it was 6% for the university, 6% for the people in the mental health institution, 6% mm-hmm. for the people who work in the Capitol. It was 6% across the board. So the first important differential was the faculty operates in a different economic environment than do other people. Faculty are not fungible as other people might be. That states it too strongly for the other people in state government, but the fact is that you're competing in a different economic market was recognized and institutionalized, if you will.
Did you believe in that yourself?
Absolutely. And let me, before I get to the second yeah. differential, which is the one within the system, let me talk about it for a moment. I believed in it, thought we ought to do it, thought it ought to be explicit, but I also felt there'd be a price. And the price, which really turned out to haunt me both ways again, was that we couldn't expect other state employees to accept this on top of they're not getting much of a wage increase to begin with. So when we entered into labor negotiations at the same time that the faculty catch-up was being debated, I had money in the budget which could get up to 6% for other state employees. I ultimately got a lot of grief on the 6%, and the legislature threatened not to ratify the contracts. That was too much, too rich. Mr. Thompson, in particular, raised particular cane about it. I was going to break the state with it. But I felt then, and I feel now, that there would have been no way we would have gotten all the other state employees to accept the explicit differential which was being created between them and the university. Mm-hmm. If we said we're going to give the university faculty up to a 15% increase in the base, and because of that, because things are tough, you're going to have to take 2%. We would have had a terrible time. It would have been a very, very difficult time. And I think, frankly, it would have been unfair. I felt that the differential made some sense, but I felt that we had to make that palatable to other state employees. Others would have a far less charitable interpretation, and I was trying to buy them off or whatever, but you don't buy people off for 6%. But that differential was a crucial one, and it'll be important in the next few budgets to make sure that's maintained, because there will be an effort, understandable effort, on the part of other state employees to hook their wagon to that star and to say, well, gee, they shouldn't be treated differently, and now we want catch up to the university people. That oughtn't be allowed to happen. We ought to understand that the university and its faculty are in a different economic environment than the rest of us, and I count myself as a former state employee who worked for the rest state service. The second differential, and the one that got all the attention and caused all the hassle, was the differential within the system. What should be the catch-up for Madison, and what should be the catch-up for Stevens Point? The Madison faculty and the Milwaukee faculty were remarkably restrained during that debate. The faculty in Green Bay, Stevens Point, Oshkosh, Eau Claire were not. And one of the very strong differences of opinion that Bob O'Neill and I had was that I felt, as a president of the system, he should call the chancellors in and knock heads and say, come on now, you're a part of the system, you're jeopardizing this, the passage of this for the entire system. Because you are looking out for your campus and the rest of the system be damned. And I clearly felt that that was the case on the part of some of the chancellors. And it got to be infectious. George Field, who was the chancellor at River Falls, came to see me at one time and said, "My God, if somebody doesn't muzzle Phil Marshall at Stevens Point, I'm really going to have difficulty. Most of my faculty knows, understands, and accepts the fact that Madison ought to get a bigger bump than we." And I'm using shortcut language again. It wasn't everybody at Madison. It was selected faculty at Madison. But he said, when my faculty sees Marshall raising Cain and saying that his faculty is being taken for granted and treated poorly in the whole business, they wonder where I, Chancellor Fields, am. Why shouldn't I be saying the same thing about the faculty here? He said, somebody has got to bring him to heel. And I had a meeting with Bob and said, "Gee, Bob, you've got to call these folks together." And he's a wonderful man. He believes in sweet reason. And he said, "Well, I'm sure I can talk to them." And I remember he was going to have a famous Halloween meeting. He thought that he could get them all down here on Halloween, and part of the reason that nobody would pay any attention was because of the shenanigans on State Street. And he was going to reason with them and tell them, "Let's all stand up for the good of the order and the whole business." Well, it didn't do a damn bit of good. Yeah. And that's how the thing almost became unraveled. And it became the principle of the thing for some people, as was immortalized in the famous quote from Ed Music, who sat before Joint Finance and said, "Don't try to cram 10% down our throats." Well, I was dumbfounded at that statement, and the legislature said, "Okay, Buster, we won't jam it down your throats. You can take a hike." It was such an impolitic thing to say. And then they went after Ben Lawton and said Ben Lawton hadn't been standing up for the faculty. And Ben was in my office, on my phone, working with legislators and faculty indefatigably to try to get this passed. And they tried to scapegoat Ben Lawton. And as you may recall from the history of the time, the thing was up the hill and down the hill more often than Sisyphus stone. It was, "Oh, it looks like it's going to make it," and then it was dead. "No, no way it's going to go." And everybody had a better idea. Representative Travis, who represented the Platteville area, had a better idea. Marlon Schneider and Dave Helbach had a better idea. I think Tom Loftus floated a better idea. When all was said and done, they came to the conclusion that what had emerged from the study committee and was in my budget was not so bad after all. They sweetened it a bit. They added a percent, it seems to me, for the, if my memory serves, for the people in the non-doctoral campuses. But what ultimately emerged looked remarkably like what had come out of the, what was the committee recommendation some several months before. But it was a terrible scrap within the university community. And we talked about this last time. It was corrosive of good relations between the university and the legislature, because the legislature did not like being put on the spot to make this decision. And it also heightened the unhappy notion of the legislature making decisions for the university. If we're going to resolve these things on pay, we're going to start telling you about what courses you ought to offer and not offer. And more of that was creeping in. And Tom Loftus, I think, was the most articulate about this, which is not surprising, very articulate man, when he said that if the university is going to throw us in the legislature the thorny problems, they should expect that they'll find us messing in their briar patch on a lot of other things as well. And it is wrong. We shouldn't be doing it. We should stay out of it. But the university, by its inactivity, is inviting us in, or is leaving a vacuum there that we'll move into. And he spoke on that issue a couple times. Have you talked to Tom at all about this?
I once asked him a couple of years ago if he'd be willing to be interviewed, and he said he would, I think I should.
He did a very fine job of reflecting on what this scrap meant to future government UW relations, and his conclusion, as I recollect, was that the worst of it would be that the legislature, having been drawn into the decision-making process, would not be easily removed from it, and that that was not a good idea. The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee School of Urban Journalism, these kinds of things were some evidence of what was starting to happen.
Mary Lou said, one thing she said was that if the Eau Claire representative had not had this health problem and been able to present the Touth position and discuss it and have it talked about in the task force, that they might have avoided some of the subsequent
plus. That wasn't my impression. Dick Coy, the fellow we're talking about, I think knew full well what was going on and could have asked to have been replaced. In the atmosphere of the commission, what was being developed seemed reasonable, seemed...
Did you ever go to meetings or talk
to
people?
Oh, yes, I would stop in every once in a while and say, keep up the good work or whatever. And I'd certainly talk to people as it was going on, and I talked to the people who were staffing it. So I was aware of what was evolving as it was evolving. But what happened to Dick, I think, was when he was sitting around with other people, what was developing appeared to be reasonable. And he is ultimately a reasonable person. But when he went back to his other environment, back with the Touth people, who have always seen merger really as a vehicle to get them on the same plane with Madison, especially insofar as compensation is concerned, he walked away from his involvement with the commission. Now, clearly his health problems had something to do with it. But I think more than that, he didn't realize, this is speculation on my part, he didn't realize the depth of feeling there would be from his Touth colleagues about this. And that once again Madison was taking advantage of the rest of them. Once again Madison was being elitist and the rest of them were being given the crumbs and the whole business. And that was the kind of rhetoric that they used in reflecting on all of this.
Well, he didn't have the strength of his convictions, it sounds.
And it might have been a part because he wasn't as well as he ought to have been, but... to give Dick his due, he was in a situation where everybody was moving, and he was there moving in one direction, and he did not object to it, in part because I got to believe that he thought it was probably made sense. But then when he had to get back home, it was harder, much harder for him to defend the commission's recommendation.
You know, someone has said that you could have early on pointed out that Madison ought to get more than the other campuses, and that would have had an effect and perhaps avoided this.
Gee, I did. When I would go to places, and again, on this, I got caught up in the whirlwind, and what I would run into is, gee, you're one of those folks who thinks Madison is better and we're inferior. And I'd say, no, I think Madison is different. Madison has the research function, it has the professional schools, it has the graduate schools. The kind of faculty involved in those things are different from the faculty who are teaching first-year communication skills. I remember I used that example. God, it comes back. And the people at Stevens Point went absolutely wild. Well, one of our communication skills people became governor of the state of Wisconsin, I'll have you know, and the whole business. There was just no listening. But I wherever I went, tried to make the case. And on most campuses, there was a substantial number of faculty who understood and
sure,
accepted that notion.
Mm.
Sure, they did. They what Tauf did, and I've been using the shortcut in my language, and all of us who were talking about it were using a shortcut, and that's what hurt. We'd say, well, Madison's going to get 15%, and say, for argument's sake, Stevens Point, 9%. Not everybody at Madison was going to get 15%. For example, somebody teaching freshman level English in Madison probably wasn't going to get any more than somebody teaching in terms of catch-up than somebody teaching freshman level English at Stevens Point. But somebody who was in the graduate program in physics here, or somebody who was doing research at McArdle here, was clearly going to get more. And we didn't do a good job of pointing out that ultimately the differential related to the kind of work you were doing and the competitive environment in which you operated. We left people with the notion that anybody at Madison, just by virtue of the fact he or she was here, was going to get 15% right off the bat. And that wasn't the case. And we tried to leave, I was anxious to leave, a fair amount of flexibility for the administration as to how to handle
the
catch-up.
You wanted a person-by-person.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. I thought, I realize those are difficult decisions to make, but I think that that's the only way to, the competition is on a person-by-person basis. People who write about what are faculty salary levels for the econ department here versus the econ department in the University of Texas may take average salaries, but if somebody's going to come up here to try to recruit someone, they're going to come to recruit the department. They're going to talk to Don Nichols or Don Hester or whomever, and that's what's important. And the university, I thought, ought to make those case-by-case judgments. But it's, I think, here we sit in 1987, with a new president of the university, I think that he has an opportunity to smooth over the rifts caused by the compensation fight. And he has the opportunity also, and I hope he'll do it, to not only continue but to enhance the differentials we talked about, to make them more clear and more explicit. That isn't necessarily bigger, but to make clear that this was not simply a one-time palliative, because if that notion ever takes hold, we'll be right back into this same fight 10 or 15 years from now, and that doesn't make any sense.
The people in the university or in the system should have been doing more of that, shouldn't they? Persuading, making the other campuses realize why there had to be a differential.
Yes, absolutely. I think, and it bothers me, tonight, as fate would have it, I'm going to the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point where they're going to give me some award of some kind. But Stevens Point was the first one to sort of throw caution to the winds and say, the hell with you. And they were very noisy and visible about it. They were the group that ran the ad in the Wall Street Journal, for example. I don't know if you recall that.
I think,
And they made lots of racket, and they made things very uncomfortable for their local legislators, who then began to have to respond to that. And when people on the other campuses saw what was going on, and that Dave Hellbach and Stan Grzynski, that was the fellow, were saying, gosh, we got to come up with something more. Then the squeeze started to come on all the other people in those campuses. And I felt very strongly that that was inappropriate for those chancellors to get involved. If some of the faculty wanted to do it, that's their business. But the chancellor's loyalty lies to the system. They are part of management. They're not part of a faculty group, by gosh. And I felt strongly that Bob O'Neill should have made that point more forcefully. I have little doubt that Buzz Shaw will. I know when I first met him, when the Regent Screen Committee or whatever had decided on him, they asked if I would meet with him and them. And it was my very first meeting with him, and we exchanged some pleasantries for a moment, and he said, Governor, I want you to know that if I get this job, I am the boss, and these other chancellors will be answerable to me. Obviously, they must. Some of these folks on the Regents must have said, this is a bone in Tony Earle's throat. Because it was one of the very first policy things that he volunteered. And it seems to me he's been good to that so far. I mean, he has made it clear that he speaks for the university, and he is not just one of several. He is at the top. His chore will be made easier, I think, by the fact that Chancellor Shane is gone. Because part of the paranoia in the non-doctoral campuses has always been that Irv Shane really ran the show here, that whoever was president of the system was not very, it was a paper tiger. Now they won't have that myth to live with, and the next chancellor, whomever he is, will undoubtedly be regarded, at the outset at least, as a bit more one of them rather than someone who has some sort of special standing in getting the ear of the president here.
I wonder how Madison will feel about that.
Well, I don't know if you followed this, but the ultimate expression of this notion that Madison runs the system has been the introduction from time to time of bills which would take central administration out of Madison. Put it in Medford, put it in Rhinelander, put it anywhere, so that if you get rid of the proximity, then you'll somehow restore a rough kind of egalitarianism. Well, it is not the proximity. I'm sure proximity has something to do with it. But it is not the proximity. It is that Madison is such a different kind of campus from all the others. And of course it is going to be the object of considerably more attention and effort on the part of the president of the system than is the two-year campus at Barron, for example. Gosh, nobody should be puzzled by that.
The task force recommended that 15, whatever it was, 12 or 10 and 4, was it 4, 5, for the catch-up. What did you think of O'Neill's move in bringing the bringing it up to 9? He did.
I think that he gave it away. I think if he'd have used it to bargain with, he might have gotten a better reception and been able to get more cooperation from the other chancellors. Let me elaborate a bit. As a matter of political reality, they weren't going to get stuck that far down. That end of it was going to get sweetened a bit.
Really? You mean the task force was just presenting what an ideal kind of figure and didn't believe
it? I think so. I think they understood. And I think the task force was most interested in taking care of the Madison situation, but they knew that they had to address the whole system. And it's awfully hard to put together a peer group that reflects what happens at UW-Oshkosh, UW-Stevens Point. Is it Bemidji State? Is it Northern Iowa? Is it Wayne State? you don't have the same framework in which to make those kinds of judgments. And it was great grist for the mill for everybody who wanted to come up with their own, you know, somebody would pick Central Michigan and then they'd pick Slippery Rock State. You know, there were always enough that you could get a reasonable number to make a plausible group of peers, but the ones that they would leave out were always more interesting than the ones they'd include. But I'm getting off my point. Their first interest was, of course, taking care of Madison. That was a bit easier to do from a quantifiable standpoint. They felt they had to do something with the other campuses. I think they must have known that that big gap between Madison and the non-doctoral campuses would be politically unpalatable. And they'd have to bump that lower end up a bit. That was pretty widely understood. What the mistake that the regents and the president made were to say that right off the bat and say, we're going to bump this up, rather than to have these other folks say, gee whiz, we're really, this isn't quite right, and the regents to be thoughtful, and the president now and say, well, maybe we can persuade the governor and the legislature to give a bit more in the holiness. But having given it away, when that pressure came for more, they started at the higher level, and they had to get something added to that to satisfy them. That's the feeling they had. So I thought it was not unreasonable that the president and regents would suggest a bit more, I don't think they got anything for it, and I don't think they handle it very artfully. And I think you'd get the same impression from legislators who dealt with it too.
Oh yes. It's tape 4 of the interview with Tony Earle. Maybe that's the academic staff issue.
Came up very late in the game. Well, it came up very late, and I thought it was something that we should try to do separately, but the pressure got very heavy to at least begin to address it in the faculty catch-up. In reflection, I think it was probably a mistake to try to do it because we didn't have very good data. The thing that has always troubled me about the academic staff question is that within the system, there is no constancy, no consistency from campus to campus as to what is academic staff. I felt that, still feel, that group of employees who are academic staff who carry out functions related to the academic pursuit, teaching, research, and the like, ought be made a part of the faculty catch-up. Those who are called academic staff whose functions don't relate to the academic pursuit, but they carry out these functions simply because they're on a campus, ought to be treated like classified personnel in the rest of state service. The university doesn't like that at all, because and what has led, in my mind, to the abuse of the concept of academic staff is because they are unclassified, you don't have to go through all the processes of hiring, promotion, termination. You can treat these people much more easily. It gives you, as a manager, it gives you great flexibility. So under the heading academic staff come lots of people whom I don't think belong there. If they were part of the classified state service, you'd have to go through a tougher process to hire them. It would be tougher to fire them. The promotions and transfers and all would be a bit more difficult. But I think that that's ultimately what ought to be done. There ought to be a rigorous review of everybody who is called academic staff and sort out those who are really involved in some sort of academic pursuit and give the university the flexibility to treat them as unclassified personnel and give them the benefits of the catch-up business. And the other people, give them the benefits of being in the classified service. I don't know if that'll happen.
No. This comes, Bri Curl sums up what's happened pretty much in the terms that it's always a question of comparing unlike institutions, and that Madison is so different from the others that it doesn't work to do the same thing for Madison. He gave many yes. examples, but this, many people would say that Madison's academic staff problems are different from the others.
Well, I think that's true, but I wouldn't have any trouble calling academic staff people who are in the research function, for example, which you wouldn't find in any of the other campuses. I do have trouble counting as academic staff on some campuses. I understand there's some maintenance people who are academic staff, for the love of Pete. I think there's something wrong with that. A grayer area are people like loan counselors and people who handle a student loan business. Is that really an academic pursuit? I don't think so. They happen to work in the environment of the university, but I don't think that's an academic pursuit. I think that they could be classified. There are some areas where it would be, you'd have a tough choice, but I think that can be and ought to be done. I think the academic staff issue is going to continue to trouble people. Witness the very quick legislative committee support for allowing academic staff to organize and bargain collectively. Mm. One vote against it in each house so far. Mm. Each of the committees boomed that through, even though the governor has said, I don't like the idea much, I wouldn't have voted for it, I won't say whether I'd veto it or not, but I'm not very friendly to it. Even after he said that, the committees met, Republicans and Democrats, boomed through, allowing them to organize and bargain collectively. That's because of the discontent. Some compare themselves to their peers in the classified service and say, wait a minute, I'm not being treated the same as them, and would seek the benefits of the classified service. Others say, boy, I'm doing the same thing as faculty, and they're getting a 15% bump, and I'm getting zip. So some identify more with the faculty, and there's that roiling discontent, which some seem to think will be ameliorated if they're given the right to organize and bargain collectively. That'll just be the beginning of the fermentation, it seems to me. If academic staff is allowed to organize and bargain collectively, there will be a real fare-thee-well between Wisconsin Education Association, Wisconsin Federation of Teachers, I'm sure there'll be a couple of independent groups will try to organize academic staff.
You would have supported that, wouldn't you?
The
organization of academic staff?
Support the right of anybody to organize and bargain collectively, including faculty, which always was a very big problem for me here on this campus. It was put aside and temporarily forgotten in 82, but boy, when the freeze question came up, or others, people said, well, yeah, what do you expect from the guy? He supported faculty bargaining. My support for that is very broad-based. It isn't that I have a feeling that faculty ought to be authorized to organize and bargain collectively. It is my feeling anybody ought to have the right to do it. I don't think it would be wise for the faculty on this campus to do it. I think they would lose much, much more than they would gain. I think the system of collective governance would go out the window. But I think they ought to have the right to do it. And in this community, which is the biggest choice community in the state, pro-choice on matters of abortion, pro-choice on matters of lifestyle, pro-choice on your views about any political or foreign matters, that is an issue on which choice is not allowed. That is an issue where people say, no, we should not have the choice and our colleagues should not have the choice. I've never understood that. Having the choice is not in and of itself dangerous. I don't think people here would exercise the choice. And I would counsel them not to, but I think they ought to have it. But
if this has all been argued in the papers, I mean, I think it would split up the system, which might be a, good thing. But what about the TA collective? Everybody, I mean, the president and the chancellor all were opposed to your approving of that and feel that that was a really bad
I think that the university brought TA collective bargaining down on themselves by the way they treated the TAs. The TAs thought they had the right to bargain. The court said, no, they don't have the right, and the university, which had been dealing with them, and it hadn't caused anybody any grief, maybe a nuisance to bargain with them, said, well, buzz off.
That was a shame decision.
That's right. We're not going to talk to you. It was a foolish thing to do. What they had very narrowly limited what they bargained about and talked about. So Shane, in effect, threw down the gauntlet to them, and they won a right to to bargain on a far wider range of things because of how they'd been treated. A very poor judgment on the chancellor's part, I think.
Did you ever talk to him about it?
No, I talked to Harry Peterson about it a bit. I didn't talk to Herb about it. It was interesting. I would hear from different people in the university with different points of view about it, depending upon what discipline they were in. The TAs and their level of militancy was as different as the disciplines are, one from the other. TAs in mathematics were far different from TAs in ag and life science, for example. So there was a real division. I didn't feel then, don't feel now, that allowing the TAs to organize and bargain is going to be the end of the world. And I think, in every case, I think that the impetus for those kinds of things comes from insensitive treatment of the people involved. And I think that's what's led to this academic staff business. I think if the university would give classified status to those who are really more akin to being classified personnel, that would alleviate a lot of that difficulty. I might be wrong, but I think it would make a real difference. And many of the worst abuses of academic staff don't come here. For example, the most notorious in my memory was the Oshkosh situation, I think it was, where rather than put a faculty person in a classroom situation, they used an academic staff person for a given period of time. Then, obviously, you didn't have to worry about tenure or any of that sort of business. And then when it served their purposes, just summarily dismissed that person.
Must have been that big case in the Regents.
Yes. It was a real abuse, I think.
And but that's, again, another institution, not Madison.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Right.
So, which comes back to, you say you got lots of different points of view from the campus. Was there any structured way through which you got a sense of what the Madison campus, I know you met with Donald Nichols, is that right?
Yes, I appointed Don as an economic advisor, and so I'd meet with him on a very regular basis. I used to see a lot of Bob O'Neill, both the...
I'm talking about Madison.
Okay. Harry Peterson, and I would initiate the contacts with Harry as much as, or more than Harry would initiate them with me. There's a story that recently got a fair amount of attention about my involvement in the Elroy Hirsch matter.
Oh, yes.
I initiated the first contact with Harry Peterson. I called Harry, and I was getting calls from people all over saying, Irv Shane is going to fire Elroy Hirsch, and the poor devil's got only a year to go, and Lord, that's uncalled for. So I called Harry, and I said, I'm getting these anxious calls, many of them from faculty, incidentally, from people who have heard this, is that true? And Harry said, geez, I think it is. I think Irv is about to can him. I said, please tell him to call me. I have to get in touch with him. He was out of the city or something at the time. I said, and tell him not to do anything until we talk. And I called Irv and I said, I realize this is presumptuous. I realize that this is your bailiwick, but you'd make a very bad mistake if, with 1 year to go, you would can Elroy Hirsch. I know that you've had differences of opinion with him and the whole business, but I said, you'll really cause yourself untold grief for a very minor matter. And frankly, you are as responsible as he is for this. You gave those people the go-ahead for this blessed raffle. They did go to see you first. They had that good sense. You said go ahead, and then when it turned into a real mare's nest, then you said, well, wait a minute here. Let's convene a court-martial. Irv did not like my involvement in it and said as much, and he was quite brusque, and I said, well, let it go at this. If you proceed to go ahead with this and fire him, I will publicly disagree with you. I don't want to do that, but I feel it would be a terrible mistake for the university and for you to do this. You will bring all kinds of wrath down on yourself for no good purpose. Let the fellow go 1 year and retire. Well, then Irv said, what if he won't retire after 1 year? I figured, well, what was in the door? I said, let me make some inquiries to see if he would retire, given the opportunity to do so. I called, well, I shouldn't mention who I called, I guess. I called a couple of people and said, what would be the situation if he were given a time? They got back to me and they said, if he can retire at the end of the academic year in 1987, he'll do it. He simply wants to go out without a can tied to his tail. He is not interested in staying on till he's 70. I then got back to Irv and said, if he's allowed to retire, he'll retire. And I think he's a man of his word in that regard, and the people who spoke to me said that, that was how it was ultimately resolved. But I cite it, it may be a highly visible example, but I cite it to respond to the nature of your inquiry. How was communication maintained? It was most often initiated by me to Harry Peterson, first and foremost, Irv, on occasion, when there'd be things coming up about which I'd be concerned, which I thought could cause some consternation. So there was not a real good day-in, day-out liaison. It was not that Irv and I didn't get along, we did. He was a rather crusty person, but we got along, and I would see him on an occasional basis, and Harry, every once in a while, being the good staffer, would arrange for Irv and I to have lunch together now and again, talk about some things. Irv did not like comparable worth, for example. We got together and talked about that. But we kept a good communication, and it was never bad blood between us, though we disagreed on some issues.
Do you think your friendship with the O'Neills would have colored his attitude to you?
I'm afraid so. And I never did understand that lack of warmth between the two of them.
You know, O'Neill did rather step into the Madison campus and take. There's the AAU issue.
Yes.
And I understand he never. Irshane wasn't allowed to entertain the regents as the other chancellors were, and that kind of.
Oh, I didn't know that. I always felt that was too bad, because they're as different as they are from one another. They're both very, very fine people.
Mm. Yeah. Well, so Harry Peterson, anybody else? Howard Temin, you seem to have.
I saw Howard Temin on a couple of occasions. He was very anxious to, in a very graphic way, show me how different his teaching responsibility was from what the average lay person might think of as a teacher's responsibility. How he might have only one or two students a year, for example, who would be with him doing very intensive, very complex research. And I visited him in his building. And I tried to make a couple other visits to various schools on this campus. People here would know that I had been at Stout, or I'd been at Parkside, or I'd been at La Crosse, or wherever. And they'd say, well, gee, you ought to come see us. And I try to do a fair amount of that. But this is a very large community, and it's hard to get to see everybody.
Was Sheila an important contact on the campus for you? I mean, did she sort of keep you...
Well, Sheila knew a lot of what was going on here, but she tried pretty hard. She tried very hard not to be a conduit. She didn't want people seeing her as an extension of me. She did not want to be a lobbyist with me, nor did she want to be an apologist for me. Mm-hmm. I understand that. I think she felt, and I think correctly so, that if she was ever perceived to be in that position, she'd have had no peace. And then people would have raised questions about, well, why is she here? Is she here just an extension of the governor's office, or does she have any legitimate function at the center? So she worked very hard not to be seen as an extension of me, and pretty successfully, I think.
Yeah. Were there any other, well, you say Don Nichols, he was the head of your economic advisory.
Right.
But was he talking to you about the campus, or he was literally...
Well, we talk about campus matters. Most of the time was spent talking about economics, but we'd talk about campus matters. And I'd see Dennis Dreesang quite a bit, Ed Sten on occasion, Hank Lardy, Ted Shannon. A lot of these people I would see in a political context or a personal context. It was not a formal connection with the campus.
Do you think there should be one for a governor?
I think it would make a lot more sense. What I tried to do as I went on, but time was always at such a premium, was to get together from time to time with various faculty members. I did entertain on a couple of occasions some people from in the area of biochemistry. It was an area that everybody tells me was a real promising area. We had some top-notch people, beginning with Hector DeLuca and others there, Burgess. I ought to get to know them, know what they're about. And so I did. And then I would hear from people, gee, there's some other younger faculty here who are really up-and-coming stars, are going to be very important in the future of the university. You ought to meet with some of them. And I did some of that at the residence. I felt badly that I didn't see more of the people here on the campus. Mm-hmm. But it's time is a governor's most precious asset, and there's never enough of it to go around.
But should there be somebody, say, in the administration who would meet with the governor once a week?
And... Oh, it'd be a very good idea. Sure. You know, the 25% of the state budget is spent on what is called state operations. The other 75% goes to school aids, local aids, highway aids, whatever. 25% is spent on state operations. Half of that 25% is the University of Wisconsin. Yet the University of Wisconsin, in terms of competing for the governor's time, doesn't get a heck of a lot more than a Department of Natural Resources, Department of Agriculture, Department of Justice. And it ought, just by virtue of the enormous dollar impact, get more attention, much less the very significant impact it has on the state, the university as a university. It ought to get more attention than it does, but the lines of communication have never been well established, I think. I always felt, for example, I always wanted to get better acquainted with Catherine Lyle. I would meet her only occasionally. I'd make a mental note to myself. I've really got to get to know her better. Gee, she is very impressive. She seems to know what's going on. And I'd forget about it till the next time I'd see her in some sort of a setting. And I'd say to myself, boy, got to do that. Got to ask Catherine to come in or perhaps set up some sort of a session. And I never did it. And as I think about it now, I still feel it was a mistake that I did not do more of that.
All right. I always say university, and I mean Madison. I meant literally. And of course, you say you had Harry Peterson.
Yes.
And I guess that would be it. You know, yeah. I mean, because I understand Ed Young, as chancellor, had a phone that went to Lucy's desk.
Was that right? Henry Meyer had one. I think that's all form and no substance. Henry Meyer had one on my desk when I got there, and I had it taken out. And nobody ever would have been the wiser except the newspapers ran a story about it 2-3 months after I was in office, that there used to be 3 phones on a governor's desk, one that went to the National Guard and one that went to the mayor of Milwaukee and one for all other purposes. Now there's only one phone. Earl had the one to the National Guard and the mayor of Milwaukee removed. Well, not for any insult, but I could call them as easily any other phone. I thought it was pretentious and foolish to have 3 mm-hmm. phones. Well, Henry Meyer was greatly offended because the cord between City Hall and the state capitol had been cut. And hell, if it wouldn't have been in the paper, he wouldn't have even known about it. So, no, I don't think having a separate phone here.
I'm not sure that's true, you understand. That's really been said.
And this may sound a bit defensive, and I don't mean it to be, but ultimately, if the university is going to have a good working relationship with the governor and with key legislators, much of the impetus will have to come from the university, because everybody is vying for the governor's time. Everybody is vying for the time of the speaker and the whole business. And our horizons are much broader. We've got to be worried about prisons and acid rain and unemployment and the university. The university's horizons are the quality of the university and the future of the university. And they ought to be a bit more aggressive in pushing their agenda and making sure their point of view is understood.
Could this be true of Madison as well?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Without a doubt. Mm. I think most especially with Madison, in part because of the proximity here, people take for granted that there is a better degree of communication.
Let's see, of course, and then there isn't. So.
That's right. Yeah. You figure, well, gee, you must know what's going on down there. And that's an assumption that shouldn't be so easily made.
Listen, I have another really important subject, and that's the regents. Your regent appointments.
Yes.
On what basis you made them?
Well, they were
who
all
you consulted with.
The consultation was mostly my own. I didn't talk to a lot of other people about it. I had my own ideas. Let me try to put them out there as best I can. There was no formula. I wanted people who cared deeply about the university, people I knew who had a strong interest in higher education, cared about the university in particular. I made a couple of reappointments, such as Ben Lawton, whom I thought so highly of, and so those were easy, the ones I was going to reappoint. I wanted to get some geographical diversity and background without picking people who would have a campus as their campus. So I didn't want a Stevens Point regent who would feel that his or her first responsibility ought to be to Stevens Point, or an Eau Claire regent who felt his or her responsibility ought to be to Eau Claire. Thus, I picked Frank Nicolay from Abbotsford, Camilla Hansen from Mellon. They represented an outstate perspective, but neither one of them were affiliated with a campus or could be made to feel beholden to a particular campus. And that's worked. I think that they both represent that kind of a point of view. I appointed Warren Knowles out of deep respect for Bob Knowles. I had told Bob Knowles that if I ever had the opportunity, I'd reappoint him. I thought he was a fine man and a great regent. I didn't have that opportunity. He died. So I appointed his brother Warren in his place out of respect for both Bob and Warren. So the motivation there was a bit different one. And I knew that Warren was a great friend of the university too. And I take some satisfaction from that appointment. I appointed Ness Flores because I thought that he is the perfect example of what relatively low-cost public education can do to benefit not only the individual but society. A migrant farm worker's kid who ended up in this state went through public schools, including the law school, up to and through the law school, became the first Hispanic elected judge in this state, first Hispanic appointed to and ultimately to chair the Public Service Commission. And we talk a lot about minority programs, but they're all in the abstract. And I think a lot of people wonder if they really are worth the candle. Ness is evidence that they are, and that minority programs ought to be given a fair shake. He also is a proponent of low tuition, which is something that I agree with. So the motivations were, the motivations differed from case to case. The only common denominator was that I wanted to name people who cared deeply about the university. Lawrence Weinstein may ultimately turn out to be one of the more controversial regents I appointed simply because he is so strong-willed. But his concern and affection for the university is unquestioned, I think.